Bing Bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I am joined by Dan Webb, who is head of engineering at Swan and co-host of the High Hash Rate podcast. We get into the potential attacks on Bitcoin mining. Is Joe Biden and his administration going to go at it? Potential attack vectors on that side of things, the ETF, and much, much more. So tune in for another action-packed episode. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast is not financial advice and strictly the opinion of Dan and myself. And go ahead and hit that subscribe button. Help your boy out. Spread the word of the State of Bitcoin podcast. Smash the subscribe button. And lastly, shout out to my sponsors, The Bitcoin Advisor. Go to thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle to set an appointment with me where I can help you buy, sell, and store Bitcoin securely. That's right, securely. We can do collaborative custody, set up an estate, plan for that unfortunate circumstance you pass. So your family members, friends, church, whoever you want can then access your Bitcoin. And big shout out to Hodler's Official. That's H-O-D-L-E-R-S official.com. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE, one word, all caps, to get 10% off your entire order of the number one jerseys in the game. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the episode. Whoosh. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got Dan Webb, the engineering lead at Swan and co-host of the High Hash Rate podcast. And before we even jump in, a national champion as well. So congratulations on that. Go blue.
Go blue indeed.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we have a lot to get into the Bitcoin mining space. But first, I want to start it right off the bat. You know, the Biden administration just issued an emergency data collection initiative to identify basically the electricity uses of Bitcoin mining industry in America. So somebody that you know, obviously has a podcast around Bitcoin mining, helps with Bitcoin mining on the side, or maybe even does a little bit at Swan, and we'll get into that later. But I want to hear your viewpoint on, is this a potential attack on Bitcoin mining? Do you think that this, I guess, affects anything going forward, or... are you think this is just another case of some needless FUD?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a little bit of this, a little bit of that to the answer. I think that if you look at it just at the surface, especially the short term, this is just bureaucrats who feel like they need something to do. They need to put out, you know, make it seem like they're doing something about a, you know, a big issue or something that's taking up a lot of energy, especially in the climate change, ESG, political environment that we're in. So if I wanted to be optimistic, I would say this is just more bureaucratic busybodies trying to put out that they're on top of a situation, that they're monitoring a situation. But ultimately, and especially long term, this is a potential threat. It's kind of like registering your weapons, registering your miners. If they determine that Bitcoin miners are using too much energy, like they do in many other countries, they may use it to increase taxes, increase regulation, and just try to capture the mining industry more broadly. So it's, I think short term, it's maybe a little bit of panic and people using engagement farming on Twitter to make it seem like a worst case scenario, but that doesn't mean that it's not a long-term negative thing that deserves pushback and deserves close attention to people in the space to make sure that this doesn't become something worse than it is.
Yeah, no, exactly. I feel that as well. But you know what kind of struck me by surprise was the failure to respond can result in like a civil penalty of about $10,500 every single day for each violation. So, you know, when you read something like this and kind of have gone through it, is this, I guess, more of an attack on the publicly traded miners, the big players?
No, yeah.
Or do you think like maybe the at-home miner is in trouble as well?
Yeah, I think the biggest risk is to some of these public miners, some of these, you know, just bigger overall operations. I think at the end of the day, you can kind of boil it down to, and it's similar with Coinbase, similar with the exchanges and stuff that they've doing, the crackdowns they've been doing the past year and a half or so. It's the government is coming for its cut. They want to get their piece of the pie. They're probably going to let most of these Bitcoin exchanges, Bitcoin miners, Bitcoin operations continue to exist as long as they pay up. And I think that that's the biggest risk. They're definitely going to go after the public miners first. That's the easiest one to get compliance from. They have the most to lose if they don't comply. But the risk for some of these smaller operations, whether it's a business, whether it's a, you know, a home miner even, is definitely going to, there's definitely risk there. I think you could maybe compare it to people who grow, you know, marijuana, right, in their house, and the energy used to do that with the lamps and some of that is easy to notice. It's just higher than the average residential energy use, and that'll just be a flag for them to look a little bit deeper. I don't know if that's coming anytime really soon, but I think ultimately that is a risk if you're engaging in you know, home mining. If you're just trying to secure the network with one of your S9s or S19s at home, you might want to be wary of that. And I think ultimately it serves to potentially drive some of this activity, you know, overseas or, you know, to foreign countries. So if you look at Texas, you look at what's Riot blockchain is doing and some others in other places in the United States, they're contributing to balancing the energy grid, and they're driving down energy costs. They're making energy grids more stable. They're creating a lot of stability and having a lot of positive effects. I think it was in Georgia, a local news broadcast was talking about a giant new miner that was coming in, and it was basically going to help reduce property taxes in that county. So there's a lot of benefits that come from these mining operations, and the risk of moving those overseas, I think that regulators, citizens, everybody should be wary of that and should be holding the government accountable if they're doing anything that is de-incentivizing mining.
Yeah, I mean, mining is already a tough enough business as it is, it seems. And, you know, obviously they've gotten a little help with the introductions of ordinals and just kind of the increased fees that we're seeing. So regardless of what your thought is on ordinals or anything like that, the miners are benefiting slightly. And, you know, they're doing a little bit better now that the price has, you know, gone up from the 20K range to the 40K range. So they're not quite as bleeding quite as bad as they were at some point in time. But this just seems like, you know, another attack. And so, you know, outside of the whole, I guess, you know, Elizabeth Warren kind of going at the ESG narrative, now the Biden administration kind of going at this and trying to get their cut, you know, I guess at this point, what else can they do except for ban mining like China did? And do you kind of, I guess, obviously it's more of a political question, but is that something that worries you in the United States as, you know, by country, the U.S. has the most hash rate, if I'm not mistaken. It's not going to be quite the 51% attack that, you know, we've you know, kind of talked about in the past as a potential failure for Bitcoin. But, you know, a big percentage of the hash rate is in the U.S. So if the U.S. decides to ban Bitcoin mining, is that going to be something that's, I guess, detrimental to the network?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a tail risk. I wouldn't say that, at least in my opinion, from my perspective, that it is a very practical risk, at least in the short term. I personally believe that government bans, state bans of Bitcoin mining generally is a leading indicator that there's an energy crisis in that region or in that country, especially in industrialized nations. You look at Europe, you look at China, both of those countries kind of banned or have been trying to ban Bitcoin mining. As a result of kind of understanding the energy crisis that they're leading into. China, most of the mining activity in China, you know, previous to the ban, but it's still existing, was most active during the rainy seasons. There's a lot of hydropower in China. And when that rainy season goes away, the excess energy that the country has from the hydro plants or the hydro dams decreases significantly. So China's adding a lot of nuclear capacity in the future. They're building a lot of reactors. They're adding coal plants. They're firing up coal plants again. And they're adding, you know, a bunch of other different energy sources to their mix, but they don't have enough energy as of right now. And I think that once that changes, I think the crackdown on mining will probably subside, but I don't have a crystal ball. But it's similar in Europe, the war with Russia, the loss of the access to the pipeline, the Russian pipeline, and the shuttering of their nuclear plants and their natural gas plants in favor of less reliable, less energy dense resources like solar and wind has caused energy prices to spike due to energy scarcity. And that's kind of what's probably motivating a lot of the crackdowns. But, you know, the United States has a lot of energy, a lot of excess energy. We're a net exporter of oil and gas. We've got a lot of, you know, renewable projects. We're lagging a little bit in the nuclear build out, but it does seem to be turning around politically so that we're going to have more nuclear energy build outs. But that being said, if we don't manage our energy grids and our energy resources in the United States, and we do kind of come into an energy crisis, you will probably start to see more crackdowns. If you look at the map of energy, or excuse me, of Bitcoin mining in the United States, the 99% of it is in regions that are very energy dense with a lot of excess energy. You don't see mining operations in California, for example, but you do see them in Texas, the Midwest, a little bit in Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Tennessee, Kentucky, where they have excess capacity, whether it's hydro, nuclear, natural gas, or other sources of energy.
Yeah, I mean, and that's an interesting point. It does seem like there was like a little bit of a shift, though, in the narrative around Bitcoin, at least in the United States, that, you know, I guess maybe the ESG narrative of it using too much energy was seemingly falling on deaf ears. And it seemed like a lot of more politicians were kind of waking up to the benefits of it. So I guess, you know, why do you think that this switch, do you think it is like the United States is kind of reaching a potential energy crisis? Or do you think maybe it's something grasping at straws here as we're coming into an election year, trying to get some more tax dollars? Put your head in the space of the current president, current administration, like why this move and why now?
Yeah, I think that overall, there's not a lack of energy and resources in the United States. I think that mismanaging those resources short to medium term could cause energy crisis. And it's also a potential issue of being isolated to geographic regions. Some states are a lot more friendly to Bitcoin mining than others. But from a federal level, to answer your question, I think that a lot of this definitely is politically motivated because it's an election year. You see a lot of, or you've seen in the past, a lot of very negative bills directed towards Bitcoin that ultimately did not pass. They didn't make it, you know, the amendments didn't make it to the final bills, but it does generate headlines. I think that politicians know just as well as what we call Bitcoin plebs on Twitter, that by tweeting about Bitcoin, you get a lot of engagement, you get a lot more impressions. And I think that politicians have learned that. So they put out a headline, whether it's pro or anti Bitcoin, and it gets a lot of people's attention, and it gets them in the news cycle for a few days, for good or bad. You know, I think that if they're trying to appeal to Bitcoin skeptics, critics, whether it's people who are focused on, they think Bitcoin's terrible for the climate, which I think is a misguided way to a perspective. But whether they believe that or not, whether they believe it's a worthless investment or just some kind of scam, the people who feel that way, they see the politician having a negative perspective about Bitcoin and trying to pass some of these bills. It gets their attention, it gets them donors. So I think this is one of those election season storms that we just have to weather. We just have to be cognizant of these bills and these proposals and put pressure on lawmakers to remove those before they get to the point where they might pass.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair to say. Maybe it's ignorance on my part, but I thought, you know, once BlackRock kind of came in and made this ETF, and a bunch of guys with a bunch of money started coming back and making these Bitcoin products, and they're making a lot of money on it, that kind of thing, this would slow down. The FUD from the top down in the United States would kind of slow. But obviously with this new proposal, that doesn't seem to be the case. So I guess what is it going to take, do you think, in order to convince these lawmakers? Is it just going to continue to get in their ear and orange pill? Or is there just like too much money to be made on one side where, you know, you think like politicians are always going to be greedy and always going to try to find something to stand on where, you know, if they're going to attack,
right,
Bitcoin, you know, is that going to be kind of the MO going forward?
Yeah. I think that when people look at the government or the state more broadly, they kind of see it as a like monolithic entity. But really, the reality is that there are multiple different interests within an entity like the state or the government, and they have competing interests. And I think that Wall Street has traditionally had, you know, its enemies or its opposition in government, especially on the Democratic Party side. So I think that it's going to continue to have this little bit of a battle back and forth. But you're right. I think that BlackRock and other, you know, asset management firms, energy companies that are starting to explore Bitcoin, offer Bitcoin products, and see the benefits and revenue from Bitcoin, that will definitely drive the opposition to Bitcoin to a more niche group, a political group. I mean, if you just think a few years ago, Bitcoin was seen very widely by Republicans, Democrats, libertarians even, and others as a very marginal project, very full of scams, not legitimate. And that's definitely changing. It's not going to happen overnight. The BlackRock ETF, for example, is a huge development, but it's not going to change sentiments overnight. I think it's a longer process. And I think that even with the ETF launching about a month ago, it's still going to take months, I think, before more investors, financial advisors, retail investors have that financial stake in Bitcoin where they own the ETFs. It's part of their portfolio. It's part of the portfolios that are offered to retirement plans. And that's just going to take time to build up. And I think as more and more people benefit from Bitcoin and the more and more people have financial stake in the protocol, the network, the asset, I think that opinions will sway a little bit. I don't think that the opposition, especially politically, is ever going to completely go away. I think it's always going to be there, and it's going to be a lot louder and a lot more prominent during bear markets when companies are failing or whatever, because they've managed their Bitcoin business or their operations, they mismanaged it. But I think overall, you'll see that opposition and the power and the influence that the opposition has will shrink.
Yeah, that's a great point. And yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see, you know, more countries come on board in Bitcoin. You know, like obviously Javier Milei in Argentina is probably a next one, the next cog to fall after El Salvador. And, you know, a lot more businesses are probably going to start to follow Michael Saylor's lead after they see how much he's up by just, you know, simply having that treasury of, you know, Bitcoin just holding on MicroStrategy's balance sheet. But, you know, you brought up Bitcoin and companies, and, you know, I mentioned it at the beginning, you work for Swan. You guys just initially talked about, or I guess announced that you've been secretly building up this mining operation. And I think like Corey tweeted the other day that it's up to 5 exahash. Is that correct?
Yeah, he actually just tweeted about 1 hour ago that it's 5.02 exahash. So yeah, the announcement made waves in the industry, and the stealth mode aspect of it was part of what made waves. And I think that the reason they were doing stealth mode was just, you know, ASIC prices were relatively low coming out of the bear market, and they didn't want to announce such a big initiative and spike the price of the hardware and all the capital that they were going to be putting into it. But they did want to build out the Swan, you know, Swan's impact on the space, especially when it comes to the institutional side. They're really trying to grow the business from just the retail Bitcoin buying app to being a service for businesses, companies, institutions, trying to become the first Bitcoin only trust company. And this was just very in line with the vision of the company, especially the attempts, the plans to go public in the next, you know, year or so. So I think you'll see more companies make moves like this. We've seen it briefly, or like maybe a year ago, there was headlines that Marathon Petroleum and Chevron had done pilot programs where they were using Bitcoin miners to help subsidize some of their operations. And I think you'll see more along that, where you'll see these larger companies partnering with different Bitcoin mining operations and businesses to kind of subsidize their costs or diversify their businesses. I think that's especially true with energy companies, because you see a lot of these midstream and upstream gas producers who are using Bitcoin mining to not only subsidize their costs, but it's actually being helpful to the environment. So instead of flaring the methane gas, they're able to burn it off and mine Bitcoin with it, which benefits the environment. It benefits the company's bottom line. And it also it reduces their regulatory costs, because when you flare methane, that comes at a cost from the government. So this kind of reduces that as well.
Yeah. And I mean, it just seems like, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer for energy companies, right? I mean, exactly like you said, it was wasted energy. Now you capture that energy and you make some profit on it. I mean, like, where's the negative here? It seems like right. It's all positives. And, you know, another thing too, another company that you didn't mention was Shell. And Shell is like one of the biggest sponsors at the Bitcoin conference in Nashville this year. I know that they were one of the biggest sponsors at the Bitcoin conference in Miami. But the interesting thing about it too is, like, you know, you mentioned the stealth mode. Is if you walked around the Bitcoin Miami conference last year, you didn't see the Shell logo like one place outside of like the list of sponsors. Whereas, like, you know, in years past, the top sponsors like Cash App, FTX, even like all those places, you saw those logos everywhere. So it is kind of interesting that a lot of these energy players are starting to get in stealth and not really, I guess, make big public announcements about it. And I think the average person doesn't really know that this is going on.
Right.
So, you know, why do you think that is, where like these energy companies are, I don't want to say afraid, but just not necessarily like making big waves about this, or, you know, kind of shooting it from the mountaintops, or even lobbying when it comes to, you know, Bitcoin mining to like a lot of these politicians?
Yeah. I think that to keep things in perspective a little bit, the Bitcoin just overall market cap is still under $1 trillion. I think it's somewhere in the 800 to 900 billion, which that's really not, for a global commodity industry, a global energy industry, that's relatively small. And the ASICs, the hardware, everything that goes into it, those industries are very small. So if Shell or any other company were to make really big, a lot of noise about their, you know, whether they're really bullish in Bitcoin, whether they're just hedging, whatever, that they run the risk of creating, you know, bringing speculators into the market to run these prices up. To make some money. And we kind of saw that with the ETFs, right? Like, the people were wondering, you know, was BlackRock going to like buy all this Bitcoin as soon as the ETFs launched? Were the ETFs priced in? That was the question. But it's, you know, I think the answer to that is, from December, or, you know, November up to January, we saw the price run up from the high 20s to ultimately almost $50,000 per coin right as the ETFs launched. And it's like, people were buying, the speculators were buying, whether it was plebs, whether it was retail, whether it was institutions, they were purchasing Bitcoin in anticipation to selling it to BlackRock investors. So making those announcements, it does create a lot of room for the speculators to come in. And ultimately, I think, or this is my personal opinion, a lot of people talk about US Treasuries being the risk-free rate for money. It's the safest. You'll get, even if it's only 1%, and that 1% is below their inflation rate, it's the risk-free rate to invest your money safely. Well, I think that some of these companies are starting to realize that Bitcoin is the risk-free rate of energy. If you have excess capacity of energy, you have oil wells, you have gas wells, you have all this nuclear energy, you're not necessarily guaranteed to have customers for that marketable energy product that comes from the resources and the capital that you own. But the Bitcoin mining network is kind of that risk-free rate. If you have excess energy, especially energy that you can't necessarily, and we see this with renewables, right? Like, there's no battery capacity for solar and wind that is really long-term. So when these energy prices basically spike negative, when there's excess wind, excess solar during the day, when people need it the least, they can sell it to the Bitcoin mining network. And I think that this information and this realization will spread across the world, across the industry, that if you have excess energy, that Bitcoin is kind of the risk-free rate for what you can sell it for, in whether you lose customers, whether you, there's, you know, disruptions and logistical problems and trade, whether there's war and conflict, you'll always be able to sell your energy.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's going to continue, just, you know, being able to sell the energy. And, you know, like we've kind of mentioned too, the environmental aspects of things, right? I mean, I think like there's going to be a flip of the switch soon with the ESG narrative of Bitcoin mining. I just don't know quite when that's going to happen. But you know, from like, I guess we'll go back to Swan for a second, and get away from like maybe the energy company's perspective of it. But from your guys' perspective, I know you can't speak for the entire company, but, you know, I guess why make this, the Bitcoin mining play, right? I mean, it is for like the institutional investors, or that's kind of seeming where like the company is sort of pivoting towards, I guess, marketing, if that makes sense. Has there been like a demand that you've seen, or that you can, I guess, kind of hint at here, of like more clients wanting to get into mining, maybe doing something similar to like, you know, a hosted mining operation, like something that River does, or some of these other companies that have, you know, the hosted mining facilities? Or is this more of, I guess, like Swan just building mining in the background to kind of help, I guess, the foreseeable future of buying a bunch more Bitcoin for their clients?
Yeah, it's definitely generated a lot of interest, a lot of demand from retail, from institutions. I think there's interest in like the hosted mining, although I don't believe that Swan has any, or they haven't made me aware or made the public aware of any plans to do something like that. But they have, it does allow Swan to diversify. It does attract investors, because Swan is like, their business is very US focused, but it is, I mean, we are a global company. So if you want to buy Bitcoin and you're in Europe, or you're in Canada, you know, anywhere else, Latin America, we're expanding operations in Brazil, especially. There's a lot of interest there. And I think that the mining operations are also not totally in the United States. They're going to be continued to diversify overseas. So we talked about earlier, some of the regulatory risks that come from operating in the United States. Well, as these risks increase, if they increase, Swan now has a diversified portfolio of customers, and accumulation of Bitcoin through mining that exists outside the United States. So it provides optionality. And I think a lot of investors are looking for that optionality. And it also creates a lot of different business relationship opportunities. I think partnering with the soon to be announced different partners that Swan is working with for the mining, it just creates a network effect, kind of a smaller network effect of potential investors and companies that we can work with and find partnerships in different business lines that we're not even currently operating in the future. So it's just, yeah, I'd say to narrow it down, it creates a lot of optionality.
Yeah. And I mean, I can agree with that statement as well. Right. I mean, it adds another arm of it. It adds, you know, the diversification of it. And, you know, I think that the kind of the name of the game that a lot of these Bitcoin companies haven't really gotten a hold of just yet is like the diversification aspect of it. Right. Because, you know, whether it was like the Bitcoin mining companies kind of being over leveraged, you know, the last bull run and then the subsequent bear crash, which caused a lot of them to fizzle out. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of startups fail, unfortunately. And I think like, you know, in the Bitcoin space, that gets kind of magnified because more people are tuned in to these companies. But, you know, I think overall it seems like it's going to be a positive for Swan to kind of add that extra arm of their, you know, of their business. And so, you know, I think as, you know, energy gets a little bit more, I guess, desirable, and as Bitcoin mining gets more desirable, I think, you know, more and more companies are going to start to do this, whether it's, I don't know, heating the office that they have with Bitcoin miners or something along those lines. Or maybe having just one or two miners in the background, kind of helping balance their own, you know, building or whatever it is. I think that these kind of implementations are going to happen at the business level and at the personal kind of home level as well as things start to develop. And so, you know, as somebody that's obviously, you know, an engineer kind of interested in that aspect of things, like, is there something that you see happening in the, maybe not the home building perspective, but maybe, you know, outside of the engineers out there just kind of fidgeting with their own miners in their houses? Do you think that that's going to become more commonplace as we move forward, as energy costs go up, that, you know, the own personal home miner, you know, maybe you can't just plug and play, but you can have a water heater, or you can, you know, heat your pool, or you can, you know, heat your home in the wintertime if you're up north, like all of those kind of things with a Bitcoin miner. Do you think that that's going to become more commonplace, or do you think that's still kind of a niche area where, you know, only the crazy Bitcoiners are going to continue to do that for, I guess, the next 5 to 10 years or so?
Yeah, and that the answer to that question kind of depends on where you are. We're already seeing a lot of what you mentioned, literally heating pools, heating homes, using excess heat for a variety of use cases. But it depends on where you are and what the price of energy is where you live. So where I live in the Midwest, you know, you can get, you know, per kilowatt hour around 10 cents, which is still somewhat high. But you go to California, you go to Europe, it's well into the, you know, 50 plus cents in some places, over a dollar per kilowatt hour of energy. I think Hawaii is the highest in the United States. So if you live in one of those places where energy costs are extremely high or relatively high, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to use Bitcoin mining for subsidizing your home heating costs, things like that. But where it does make sense is if you live in a place with low energy, especially if it's cold, you could run miners in your basement and use that excess heat to reduce your energy bill and make a little bit of money on the side. You could use it to, like you said, heat your pool. I mean, hell, you could even run pipes underneath your driveway to keep it from icing over. Don't have to shovel your driveway when it snows. But I think that where energy costs are really low is not... like I said, you got to live in a specific place. So we're outside of that. It's probably going to be more of a hobby. Now, if you want to scale it up to go kind of back what we were talking to an industrial use, that's where it does make more sense. Whether you're mitigating your regulatory costs from flaring gas, whether you're subsidizing your production costs of oil, maybe on a rig or on an oil field somewhere in the United States, otherwhere, just by mining Bitcoin at scale. In those places, you're reducing your costs. And I think that Marathon, and I don't know how much this has persisted, especially as the hash rate's gone up, but I think they were able to reduce their production costs of oil in their trial experiment by like 90% over the course of a quarter, which is huge. I mean, that's huge. A lot of the energy industry relies on government subsidies to exist profitably. So if you can reduce that, you kind of have this free market subsidy that makes oil and a lot of other energy production much cheaper and much more likely to occur if they can find a way to create, revenue that is predictable and stable for them going forward. And it could probably provide an opportunity for them to hedge in the future. So I think we'll see more of that, whether it's from the retail home level scale to in the industrial scale. But it doesn't come without risks. I don't think we've mentioned yet that the halving is coming up in April. And so the Bitcoin reward is about 6.25 Bitcoin per block. And that's going to move down to just over 3 Bitcoin per block for the next 4 years. Now, we have seen the transaction fees rise because of ordinals and other similar activity. We don't know yet, because it's so nascent, that that's going to sustain. So there's a lot of risk in the next year to 4 years when it comes to being a Bitcoin miner, whether it's at home or it's your business. Is are you going to be able to mine at low enough costs that you can sustain your operations?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the industrial aspect of things, I think that's pretty interesting, right? I mean, you know, from my perspective, I just see it as like a no-brainer for, you know, I guess marijuana facilities, you know, some greenhouses, that kind of thing. Yeah. I didn't even think about heating your driveway. I mean, I'm spoiled down here. I'm in Florida, so I never have to think about or worry about snow. But I mean, I guess that's obviously like a huge problem, and you gotta figure out ways to cut costs in that aspect of things too. So the way that the mining industry is going, it really excites me, because, you know, it's just going to bring a ton more innovation into the field, into the space. And, you know, I just globally, just how we think about energy, I think is just ever changing. And so, you know, with that being said, this is also, you know, the first bear market that we've seen the hash rate increase. So, you know, with that hash rate increasing, and you mentioned it, the halving coming up here in April, you know, what do you see as like the future of like the Bitcoin mining industry? Do you think that, I guess, the computing power and what we need, you know, to kind of keep the network just chugging along and mining to be a profitable experience, do you think that that's going to continue? Or do you think, like, I guess the more like industrial and like innovative ways that we're going to have to go is I guess less reliant on the price and less reliant on the spread that you can make, and like relying on like the energy usage, if that makes sense.
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know for sure what's going to happen, but I will say that I think that the hash rate is a better futures market, if you want to look at it that way, than, you know, even the Bitcoin futures market on the, you know, the CME, because futures markets, you know, just on like a regular exchange, that invites a lot of speculation, a lot of speculators, even retail people buying tons of options, puts and calls, just trying to make some money with very little invested capital. But if you look at the hash rate, that is companies, that is nation states, even what we've seen, investors collectively investing real capital and putting real effort to build real operations in the anticipation of profit in the future. And I think that that is very, if you look, just look at the hash rate and how much it has grown, especially in the past few years. And like you said, the first time we've seen hash rate increase during a bear market, I think that's incredibly bullish. I don't know if that will work out, and I don't know what, you know, maybe their anticipated price range is to make that investment. But I think that much energy and activity moving into the space and investing into the space is probably a very bullish sign. Now, that doesn't mean that a lot of these businesses and public miners even aren't going to run into problems. I think that we call it the block subsidy, right? Which is a subsidy. So any industry that is subsidized is typically less efficient than non-subsidized industries. So the less efficient miners, the less efficient producers are going to struggle. And if they are not able to figure out how to mine and operate more cost effectively, they run a lot of risks of going out of business in the next few years. Now, if the price does rip and we start to see six-figure Bitcoin sustain itself into the future, which I do think we'll see in the next year, that changes a lot of things. But as of right now, if you're a Bitcoin miner, I think you have to be planning and operating under the assumption that of like the kind of the worst case scenario, where Bitcoin price doesn't necessarily rise, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 or 4x or more, and that the halving is going to reduce that subsidy, and that ordinals is still too early to kind of count on that revenue, that transaction revenue. But there's also other proposals in the works, potentially like covenants that could change that and could increase the revenue from transactions. But again, it's way too early to count on those things.
Yeah. What kind of things are you talking about? Is there something that's caught your eye that, you know, could potentially increase the revenue from transactions that you're seeing? That obviously it is early and we don't know how ordinals is going to pan out, if they're going to get priced out or whatever, but is there something else that you're noticing or seeing, maybe a trend that, you know, could increase that transaction cost?
Yeah. Like I said, it's a little early, and it would require a consensus change and a soft fork, but OPCTV, which is the covenants proposal would change Bitcoin in a way that allows users to create transactions, which kind of limit the functionality and who can spend that in the future. One of my favorite use cases that I would be interested in experimenting with, if this does reach consensus and it does activate on the Bitcoin network, would be vaults, which essentially you could create a vault for your Bitcoin stash. So you've got 10 Bitcoin. You create a vault that if that Bitcoin was moved and you weren't the one that moved it, so somebody compromised your private keys or they hacked your computer and they move your Bitcoin to like their wallet, you would have the opportunity to create a transaction which sweeped all of that Bitcoin back into a different wallet that you were more sure that was not compromised. So that it just provides a lot more functionality and use cases to the end user that help them essentially protect their Bitcoin. And there's also proposals, it's called ARC, and there's another one that's very similar to ARC that I'm slipping on the name right now. But essentially it would allow people to use the Lightning Network more efficiently to be able to receive offline. And it would create what's called virtual UTXOs that people could essentially purchase and have the right to spend at a later date, which would greatly reduce the transaction costs for individual users. But the expectation would be that it would create so much more demand that overall the transactions on the Bitcoin network would increase, and it would therefore increase the revenue.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you're talking about maybe like Cashew or something like that. Is that what you're
No. So though Cashew and other eCash implementations like Fediments, they would be kind of similar. It would be similar to the custodial Lightning, like Wallet of Satoshi, Cash App, but it would be more limited to, instead of, you know, your private keys being controlled by some corporation, some public company, you could actually break it down. So whether it was your community, your family, you could have a Fediment for your family. You could have a Fediment for your church. You could have a Fediment for your union, your Bitcoin meetup, whatever you want. The keys would be distributed and control however you decided to implement that. But you would have this Fediment, which would be, you would have a wallet and your Bitcoin would be secured. You could send that in and out of the Fediment, whether it was to other members, outside to a business, and the fees on those transactions would be extremely low. And your keys would be a little bit more secure in the fact that, you know, it was people you trusted in your community that had like a distributed consensus, essentially a federation, if you will, of who would control those keys. So you're less likely to get screwed over or get rug pulled by a company or a government, right? It would be a little bit more secure than that.
I was about to say, yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. And yeah, I mean, I know whether you like Liquid or not, it's basically an on-chain version of Liquid, right? I mean, it just kind of, that's what we're kind of working towards. And I think like it's a little bit more appealing to, I guess, you know, the average person in kind of like a community, right?
Sure.
I mean, we kind of lined it out, but I also, what's something that worries me about that, I mean, this is probably a full another rabbit hole that we don't have to dive down, but is that the potential of like governments then kind of working together and creating their own, you know, in a sense.
Of course.
And that's kind of where we get into some bad spots, right? But
right.
I mean, I think we'll see where it goes. I mean, there's a very interesting, arc of where Bitcoin goes, where Bitcoin mining goes, where the transactions go. I mean, I think like it's all just, I don't know, it's all way in front of us. But, as we're kind of going through some of this, we did mention this at the beginning of the show, how, you know, you're a podcast host as well. You got the high hash rate or high hash podcast. And, you get to talk to a lot of interesting people as well on there. So is there something that somebody that you've had on your podcast that, you know, I guess has kind of, I guess, maybe shifted your thoughts or maybe changed your view or maybe opened your eyes on some way that around Bitcoin that you, I don't know, could get you kind of excited about where things are going or that you didn't initially think about that, I guess, really stands out to you?
Yeah. And to clarify a little bit, it's the High Hash Rate podcast. The name is a kind of a pun. We don't specifically talk about Bitcoin mining necessarily, although we do have miners on. It is actually kind of a if you look at the logo, it's a pot leaf, it's a marijuana leaf. So we kind of get stoned and we talk about Bitcoin from a very, I mean, it's, so the reason we went with this name and this theme was because Bitcoin is very technical, is very, people in the space are very opinionated, and it's very defined what Bitcoin is. However, if you kind of separate that protocol from being a protocol to kind of a broader idea, you can explore a lot of different ways that Bitcoin affects society. And Bitcoin, we say Bitcoin fixes this to a lot of things in the community. Well, we actually dive in with people from different backgrounds, different points of view, and where they're coming from and where they see how the fiat monetary system has created problems and corruption from their point of view, and how Bitcoin can actually fix that. And we kind of do it from a, you know, the stoned aspect of it, because we're just putting out big ideas, right? I don't want to say it's kind of cliche, but I was definitely inspired by listening to Joe Rogan for so many years, you know, 10 or so years ago. They're talking about very high level ideas, and there's not necessarily a whole lot of proof or empiricism that you can put behind your thoughts, but you're just thinking about things in a new way. And we didn't want to get people upset by saying the wrong thing, right? But we talked to a lot of really great guests. And I think one of my favorites, his name is Eric V. Stacks. And he's a cannabis farmer in California. And he puts out a lot of these videos where he's talking about how Bitcoin fixes these different aspects of society. And it kind of the theme around that is the way it aligns people's incentives. So whether you are in it for the number go up, you're in it for protecting the environment, if that's what your thing is, to mitigate methane. If you're in it for fixing the energy industry, if you're in it for fixing just the ability to save for the future, it aligns your incentives so that everybody can participate in this network and participate in this technology and benefit from it without the guilt or the negative feeling that you might be screwing somebody else over, that you've got trade deals, like the government creates these trade deals that may benefit the United States or may benefit another country, but it does that at the it hurts somebody in the process. It does it at their expense. And Bitcoin reduces that negative feature in the money system so that the people who are benefiting from it without hurting somebody else. And so by aligning those incentives, I think it creates more cooperation, more collaboration, more likely to have peace. I think there's just a very broad set of problems that a monetary solution like Bitcoin can really improve the conditions for everybody who's involved.
Yeah, and I mean, I couldn't just help but thinking about that Elon Musk meme when he was on Joe Rogan, you know, smoking the weed, just like looking at the little joint and kind of like eyeing it a little bit, and just him saying, you know, fix the money, fix the world. That's just kind of what I just kind of the vision that popped in my head when you're going right through this, because I mean, you're nailing it on the head, right? I mean, that's basically the mission behind Bitcoin is like the money, the way that we've structured it now since 1971 when we, you know, I guess officially went off the gold standard. It's just everything has kind of, you know, deteriorated in a sense. So, you know, I guess I'll ask you another theoretical question here, like get your joint ready. But how do you think that we get to this, I guess, Bitcoin standard world? Do you think it's a complete and total crash? Or do you think it's more of like a gradual? How do you kind of foresee us getting to more of a Bitcoin standard?
Yeah. I think because Bitcoin is you have to opt in. Nobody's forced to use Bitcoin. I guess you could say that they made it legal tender in El Salvador, which kind of required the banks and others to be interoperable with it. But generally speaking, people choose to use Bitcoin and they make that voluntary decision to do so. And I think that because over time, and I don't know if this is going to happen the next year, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, I think because Bitcoin is such a energy sound, efficient system, that people will just, you know, at the individual level, at the organizational level, at the nation state level, just slowly gravitate towards using it because the alternatives will over time fail from the stress of the system. They can try to keep the balloon or the bubble inflated for only so long, and eventually it's just not going to work. I mean, you can print all the money you want, but at the end of the day, is one of the sayings I like to use is that the universe or God's the only payment that he accepts, or that the universe accepts for man's debt, is energy. And you can print all the money you want in the world, but you can't print energy. And I think that maybe something comes along that's better than Bitcoin. I doubt it. I haven't seen anything so far, but I think it's definitely the most far along, that people individually and collectively will just start to gravitate towards it. I don't know if that means that it will be the global reserve currency that central banks hold and use for settlement between other countries and other central banks, but slowly that the ethos of Bitcoin will either they'll adopt it explicitly, or the ethos will bleed into the monetary system so that they're very much in sync. And I don't know how much time that will take, but I think it will come. And I High Hash Rate is kind of a podcast for people who see that that Bitcoin is probably the best solution already. They've already figured out, we fixed the money. Now until people adopt it, right? But once people adopt it, we fix the world, and we start to explore different avenues of how we fix the world since we've already fixed the money.
There we go, man. I love it. Well, Dan, you've been very generous with your time, so I really appreciate you coming on the pod. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find a little bit more about you and tune into the High Hash Rate podcast?
Yeah. I'm the engineering manager at Swan Bitcoin. So you can find us at Swan, swan.com. You can find me on Twitter at Heartland Bitcoin. There's no vowels in the heart part of that word, so it's HRTLND Bitcoin. You can find us at High Hash Rate on Twitter as well, and highhashrate.com.
There we go. And that'll all be in the show notes, so everybody go and check them out. And Dan, thanks so much, man.
Man, thanks so much for having me.